Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
When was the last time I took a road trip? How many national parks could I hit in 2 weeks? What about hotels? Wait, hey, Erica, how much am I spending on travel?
When your questions about life turn into questions about money, there's Erica, the virtual financial assistant to help you spend, save, and plan smarter. Only from Bank of America. What would you like the power to do? Erica is only available in the English language. You must download the latest version of the mobile banking app, only available on select mobile devices. Your chat may be recorded and monitored for quality assurance. Message and data rates and additional terms may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello and welcome to The Rest Is Money with me, Robert Peston.
And me, Steph McGovern. So, I want to know, the last time we spoke, you were about to go off and interview Rachel Reeves. Tell us what happened, Robert.
You know, she was very cautious. They have decided that they can give no hostages to fortune in terms of saying anything about how they're going to fix the country that would cost money. So, you know, her whole chat, which we broadcast last night on my show, was about how she's going to find money from taxation or from the private sector to do everything that they've promised. As you know, the Chancellor sets some, he shot, to use that cliche, the Labour tax foxes. She had said she was going to raise £2 billion by abolishing tax breaks for non-doms. He's now done that in the budget. So, and he spent that 2 billion quid. So that's 2 billion quid that she has to find from other sources. I asked
her. Was she raging about that?
No, I mean, she was trying to make a virtue of it. You know, she's trying to do that thing which all oppositions do when their policies get nicked, which is to say, look, we're obviously ready for government. If we're coming up with policies that the government is nicking, you know, that shows that we're really in power, which is a perfectly reasonable line to put out. Unfortunately, it's a line that people forget quite quickly. What they're more interested in is if she's promising, as she is, to sort of reduce waiting lists in the NHS, if she's promising to set up these breakfast clubs in schools, and the money for all of that is coming, was supposed to be being provided by the money raised by abolishing the tax breaks for these wealthy overseas individuals who live here. But the Chancellor has already nicked all that money. She's got to find it from elsewhere. And all she would say about that was that she's working on it, and that by the time we get to the election, she'll have found new sources of revenue, other taxes, presumably, to make up that 2 billion hull. There's another hull, to be clear, which is he extended the windfall tax on oil and gas companies by an extra year. That's a good £1 billion that she was counting on that he again has trousered and spent. She did point out that she's also changing the nature of the tax to raise more money from it in general, but there's still an extra billion that she has to find. What was interesting, she did say something about that. That money was being used for investments in making energy in this country carbon neutral. So, you know, investment in renewable energy, investment in the grid to connect renewable energy to our homes to reduce carbon emissions from power by 2030. That's their pledge. What the interesting thing she said, and I don't know if this is going to prove to be naive, it's certainly going to be challenging, is that the money that she's lost, she'll try and get from the private sector in the form of voluntary investment. Well, we'll see whether the private sector is going to stump up, whether she needs to find some money.
So It's been less than 24 hours, hasn't it, since the budget came out. Lots of people picking through it, trying to work out what it means for them. So we, in this episode, have picked out some of the things we think are relevant to business, to the economy, to all of us. We're going to talk about the ISAs, this British ISA. We're going to talk about the child benefit salary increase, which I think is really interesting. We're going to talk about capital gains tax and the fact that that's coming down. And, you know, lots of people are seeing it as a tax cut for landlords, and the VAT threshold being increased as well. But let's just start off on the ISA, because we have talked loads on this podcast, haven't we, about companies listed on the British stock market and the fact that they're performing poorly, quite a lot of them, and about the exodus of some of the big ones, you know, who are moving their listings to the US. So the Chancellor wants to encourage more of us, what he calls retail investors, so, you know, people like me putting money into the stock market, to invest in British listed companies. So he's announced this Great British ISA, which will basically give savers an extra £5,000 allowance, where you're not paying your tax on your returns, if it's invested in UK listed companies. So you currently get £20,000 a year without having to pay tax what you make, but this would then bump it up to £25,000 a year allowance, as long as £5,000 of that is going into UK listed companies. Now, there's two problems I want to talk about with this, Robert. So one is the fact that, is this actually going to improve the performance of companies if we as retail investors put some money towards them? And secondly, is it worth it for the investor? Because the tax relief you get on £5,000 invested might not be as much as the returns you get on foreign investment, even after you've paid tax on it. So is it worth it for everyone in all of this? What are your initial thoughts on it, Robert?
I think it's important to remind people why the relative low valuations of UK companies matter. And the problem that the Chancellor is trying to address is that the normal way of valuing companies, which is by a ratio of their share price to their earnings, or the ratio of what they pay out to investors in dividends to their share price, on those measures, British companies look very cheap compared to, say, American companies or companies in other jurisdictions. And why that matters is it means that if you are a company trying to raise money by issuing shares on the stock market, you have to pay more for that money. So you have to pay a bigger dividend relative to your share price. That's like borrowing at a higher interest rate. Okay. And so what it means is that your so-called cost of capital is higher than companies that are American or companies that are French or companies that are German. And if your cost of capital is higher, then, you know, it is much harder for you, it's much more expensive for you to invest in new projects or to buy other companies and do all those things that we need companies to do to grow and become more successful and indeed grow their employment. So what he's trying to do is encourage more money to go into the stock market to drive up the prices of these shares so that it becomes cheaper for companies to issue shares and expand. Okay, so that's the fundamental problem that he's trying to solve.
I just don't think necessarily, though, that the incentive is there for the retail investor. For example, you know, I'm a retail investor. I've got stocks and shares, ISAs. You know, I was just looking at mine last night. I've had my managed stocks and shares ISA since 2017. I've made 45% returns on it in that time, which is massive. But the majority of my investment is in American listed companies. It's all the tech companies we keep talking about.
You all have done brilliantly from the boom in the Magnificent Seven, the the Alphabets and the Microsofts and all of them, which have gone through the roof over the last couple of years. That's why you've done well.
Only a tiny fraction of my investment in this ISA is into British companies. And then if you look, I mean, that's just me, but if you look more widely at this, like AJ Bell have done some research on it, and they say an investor who's put in £5,000 a year over the last 10 years in a tracker that's following the FTSE All Share, so the British listed companies, would have made over £67,000. So £17,000 return. But had that money gone into US stocks, it would be worth over £113,000. So over 63 grand of profit. So even if you're paying the higher rate of tax on that in this country, you're still making way more than the equivalent if it had have gone into UK listed companies. Is the incentive going to be there for retail investors?
So I think the reason there is an incentive is straightforwardly that this is an extra £5,000. You know, there are plenty of people who take the view that the performance of the UK stock market cannot be as bad as it has been over the last 10 to 15 years and in the next 10 to 15 years. And therefore, if you happen to be lucky enough to have, and you know, let's be clear, £5,000 is a lot of money for people, but if you happen to be lucky enough to have £25,000 to invest in any given year, you know, why wouldn't you put £5,000 of that into UK equities as a sort of bet that the future can't be as bad as the past? I mean, the thing though to point out is there is literally no way that this British ISA, this £5,000 top up from retail investors into the UK stock market is going to solve the problem which I identified, which is the relative undervaluation of UK shares. Because the point about all stock markets is they are dominated by institutional investment. Although because of the ease of trading online, there is more now, you know, ordinary punters buying and selling shares in stock markets across the world. But the big weight of money is still from pension funds, hedge funds, and those big organizations that gather together our funds and then invest huge. The reality is that this British ISA is a little bit of extra money on the margin, but it ain't going to change the valuation of our companies on its own. The big challenge for any government, and you know, the Chancellor did talk about this yesterday, is how do you get pension funds to invest in size in British shares? Because as we've discussed before, the big story of why UK shares have underperformed over the last 20 odd years is that pension funds have massively decreased their investment in the London stock market. About 20 years ago, pension funds, you know, owned in terms of, you know, their portfolios, something like 40 to 50% of their portfolios would be in British shares. You know, it's now down, depends how you measure it, depends which fund, but it's down to single figures. It's down to somewhere between 3 and 6%, depending on how you measure it. So basically, British pension funds are not investing in any sense, let's use that emotive word, patriotically. They've gone for the money. They've gone for the returns that you've been talking about, that you've gone through for your own life. They've invested internationally, and they've typically shunned British companies. And the only way to improve the performance of British companies on the British stock market, if you're doing it through a weight of money technique, as it were, if it's to do with just getting more money into the stock market, is you've got to persuade those pension funds to take bigger risks on British companies. And he talked about this. One of the things he said he would do is he would sort of name and shame pension funds, because one of the things he is doing is he has come up with this new arrangement where he's saying they have to disclose publicly what the balance is. This is not something they have to do at the moment. They have to make a public statement of how much they're investing in the UK and how much they're investing in internationally, in the hope that this somehow shames them into investing more in the UK. Now, I don't know if what they're basically focused on is making money for their, you know, for their savers, whether this will remotely shame them into investing in the UK, but he thinks it'll have an effect.
Shame feels like the wrong word, though, because they're just doing, if you are someone who's got a pension in one of these companies that's trying to get the best returns for you, I'd be more annoyed if they were investing in British companies and my returns were less than I would be if the Chancellor was calling them out saying they haven't been investing in British companies. If I was about to retire, or if I was someone who was relying on this pension, I wouldn't care whether which companies it got. Well, I suppose morally you might care about some companies, but I still think the financial company investing would be in more trouble if they'd gone for lower returns than if they you know, we're putting them in foreign companies. So if shame just feels like the wrong word, it doesn't feel like the incentive needs to be there. It shouldn't be that you should be shamed into doing something. It should be that you, the incentive should be British companies should be better. They should have better productivity. They should be performing better. And that should be the attraction, not shame. I always hate it when we have systems like that.
Look, I agree with you that at the end of the day, pension funds and their trustees have a fiduciary duty to simply earn the maximum amount for their savers. And if they don't feel that they're going to get that from British companies, no amount of so-called transparency or naming and shaming is probably going to make a difference.
The other issue we talk a lot about on the podcast to do with British companies is them not listing in the UK and choosing to list elsewhere. You know, like the number of companies listed in the UK has fallen by a fifth since 2019. But there's been this interesting thing going on where I guess Jeremy Hunt's been on the charm offensive, hasn't he? Because we've talked about Shein, which is this fast fashion chain. At one point, it was valued more than H&M and Zara combined, just to give you a sense of how big this is. It was founded by a Chinese billionaire. We did an episode about them at Christmas, and the company using AI, aren't they, to kind of identify trends and push out thousands of garments every day. They have something like 600,000 things listed at any one time. Now, at Christmas, we were talking about them possibly listing in the US. But since then, Jeremy Hunt has been meeting with the executive chair. He met with him last week to try and convince them to list here. Or that's what we think happened at this meeting.
Yeah, he schmoozed him.
And obviously, you know, lots of people saying this would be great, but also people who are raging about it, because part of the reason they're looking at now listing in the UK and not the US is because they probably won't pass the regulatory things that they need to in order to list in America, which suggests that we're obviously going to give them an easier ride here. And given, you know, there's been various lawsuits and things to do with, you know, the way they make products, there's been accusations of industrial espionage, there's been criticisms about the pollution of fast fashion and everything else. There's also retailers kicking off this week saying that Shein used tax loopholes. Do we want them? Is this the type of company we want to be listed here? Are we like, you know, if we're going to give them an easier ride, that's not great either, is it?
I mean, look, it is absolutely fascinating that a British Chancellor wants Shein to list here, given that at the heart of all the problems that they're facing in the US is simply that, you know, the consensus in the US is you don't help Chinese businesses at the moment. And there are plenty of Tory MPs who, you know, if it comes to it, will be anxious about Shein listing here. I guess the other point about all of this that we need to think about is, you know, to go back to the problem that the Chancellor is trying to solve, which is that British companies are not valued highly enough, or shares listed on the London Stock Exchange aren't listed highly enough. Traditionally, if investors feel that regulation keeps them safe, then they will put a premium on that and they'll pay more for a company which they think is less risky. The problem with essentially the London Stock Exchange setting itself up as the stock exchange where risky companies could and should come is, truthfully, I don't think that will improve the valuation of those companies, because investors will just say, oh, if they're listing in London, they must be dodgy, right?
Exactly, which is definitely a reputation we don't want.
Which is a reputation we don't want and is not going to reduce the cost of capital for companies listing here. So look, I completely get why it's really important to any British government for the London Stock Exchange to be a home for really big international businesses. And, you know, one of the things we have talked about often on this program is how damaging it is to the UK that there's been this procession out of the UK stock market. But whether, you know, engaging in a race to the bottom in terms of regulation is the way to solve that, I'm just not so sure.
Right. I think we should have a break at this point. And when we come back, we'll chat through some more of the big news from the budget.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
Welcome back to The Rest Is Money with me, Steph McGovern.
And with me, Robert Peston.
So, you know, when we go into these weeks of like budgets and things, and obviously we're going to talk about a few more of the things now, you know, they weigh on your mind, don't they? And you sent me, I was in bed the other night and you sent a text to the group chat at about 12:30. Thanks for that. And I saw
you
this.
You're shaming me on my texting habits.
Sorry. WhatsApp, it was 0027. And it was kind of asleep, but I saw I don't know how, but I just looked at my phone and I saw your name there, but I didn't open the message and I fell back asleep. I then had the weirdest dream, right, about you'd invited me around to your house and for whatever reason, I ended up staying there, not in a dodgy way. And I was there with your family, not all legit. But the next morning, I went down for breakfast and I was still in my pyjamas and sat in the kitchen was Jeremy Hunt and his wife and Keir Starmer and his wife. And you were like in a dressing gown. You were like, oh, hi, guys. And I'm like, this, you know, they're in your kitchen. And you were like, yeah, they come here every Sunday. Every Sunday at 10, they just pop round for a chat. And it was the most of it. And I woke up going, I bet that's something that probably does really happen. I've foreseen the future.
I actually think it's a new, do you remember, God, I can't remember which show it was on, At Home with Slade. I actually think, you know, At Home with Keir and Jeremy will be a comedy gold classic. We've got to put it on television.
Let's come back to actual things in the budget rather than my imagination. So I'm really interested in the child benefit salary increase. So I'm just going to explain this for people who don't know. So the threshold has been increased. So this is the point at which child benefits, which you get, start tapering away. So originally it started at when you were earning 50 grand, but now that's gone up to 60 grand. And the point at which you don't get any child benefit is now going up from 60 grand a year to 80 grand a year. Now, we heard the Chancellor say that this will make 500,000 families better off by an average of almost £1,300 per household. What's interesting to me about this is it's a threshold that hasn't moved since 2013, which in itself is crazy given inflation and, you know, the cost of looking after a child and childcare costs and everything else, how much they've gone up about it. But the other element to this as well, which I know the Chancellor is now going to consult on with a view to trying to change it in the next couple of years, is about moving to a family income rather than an individual income. And the example being, if you've got two parents earning £49,000 each, they get child benefit in full. But if you've got one parent or single income where it's 50 grand, they'd start to see their benefit being cut, which I've had so many conversations with my friends about this, about how that isn't fair. So there's a consultation, isn't there, looking into changing that. But I think this is a really important point from a business perspective about getting parents and more often than not mums back into work. I think this is because childcare costs, if you look at how much it costs to send a child under two to nursery part-time, 25 hours a week, it's £7,000 a year. That is an incredible sum. So if you're not able to go back to work until your child's, you know, over two because it's worth your while, you know, it's cheaper for you to stay at home and look after your kid rather than go into work, you can see why the child benefit threshold going up could actually make a difference to employment. I can see that way more than, you know, what we were talking about on the last episode about changing national insurance and how that will get people into it. I can see this one much more clearly. What do you think, Robert?
Well, look, obviously there are a pool of people who, in the shape of parents, who you know, have a choice in terms of how much they work. And, you know, if you increase the incentives, you know, either to work at all or to work more hours, of course, it'll make a difference in terms of their availability for, you know, many, many different forms of employment. So I imagine it will have an impact. But there's just also just a sort of straightforward fairness point. One of the, you know, really sort of mad and toxic aspects of any kind of tax system, particularly the kind of tax system we have, which is a mixture of tax benefits and tax debits, as it were, is that, you know, at all sorts of different levels of income under our system, the marginal tax rate becomes incredibly high when all sorts of different benefits get withdrawn because your income is going above a certain level. And, you know, there are certain points, I think there is a particular point around £100,000 where, because of the interplay of, in particular, the kind of help you get with childcare costs, when you go over a certain level of income, you actually become poorer because the amount you lose in help from the government is greater than the money you're earning. Now, that is mad, right? It is mad to have a tax and benefit system where it's different. If you're trying to encourage people to work more and make more of themselves, the state should not be penalising you for the additional work you do.
Yeah, this actually neatly links on to the VAT threshold being increased, because this is another one that hasn't changed since 2017. But what we heard the Chancellor say yesterday is that the point at which you have to start charging your customers VAT will go up from £85,000 a year of your turnover to £90,000. Now, it's interesting this. I was talking to Heather Self, who's a tax expert who I've interviewed like a million times in my life, but she's really good at explaining all this. And she was saying there's lots of evidence that businesses just bunch up below the threshold. So for example, if you're a plumber, they will just stop working when they get to £1,000 before they'll hit that turnover threshold. And so what this is doing is just moving that bunching along a little bit. You know, there's not necessarily going to massively increase businesses' productivity, because they won't want to tip over into that bracket of suddenly having to increase their prices by 20% to include VAT. So although it's good that it's gone up a bit, it doesn't feel like it's gone up by enough, that VAT threshold, to make much of a difference to smaller businesses.
Look, we know, and I think it is, many thousands of businesses will be exempted from all the admin that becoming VAT registered imposes on you. There are lots of businesses who just hate the idea of having to create VAT accounts every 3 months and submit, you know, and then handing over the net VAT over, you know, on that period. And, you know, so there is, you know, inevitably various lobby groups for small businesses welcome the move. You know, is it going to be transformative for the prospects of small businesses? No, I very much doubt it. I've been VAT registered for good, I don't know, 25 years or something. I mean, I just factor it into my life. You know, you just get used to it. Is it a real chore
for
you?
Yeah, you do. But I do think there's that point, you know, and obviously I'm VAT registered as well, and I've been for a long time. But for example, with one of my friends who's a driver, he suddenly started getting a lot more work, which pushed him over that threshold. And he felt so bad about having to tell us all he needed, you know, to charge 20% extra. He, you know, because he did see it as that. He saw it, even though, you know, it's a tax, he just saw it as him asking his customers for more money. And, you know, I was reading some research about this. Again, Heather was telling me all about it, that there was some research done last year suggesting that 26,000 businesses are stalling on growth so they do not have to pay this VAT. So I wonder if there needs to be more of a taper on that. I don't know whether you had this, but when I first did VAT, there was kind of an incentive around you can charge 20%, but you only need to pay back 12% to the tax man, which was an incentive then, because, you know, you're then getting this 8% of basically free money. I don't know whether that still exists, but you do wonder if maybe a tapering would be something that would help in this instance, so that there was more of an incentive.
I certainly agree with you, and I think it's an important point you've made, that anything that deters businesses from being more ambitious is not great for the economy. And, you know, the point that you made, that there are just too many businesses that will not grow their income above a certain level, or at least certainly not grow their declared income above a certain level.
Yeah, good point.
Because, well, but it's also, but I mean, that's also bad for the government, because the more that you are creating incentives for businesses to, you know, essentially operate in the black economy, charge cash, not disclose it, I mean, that's also incredibly bad for the government. It's not just bad for, you know, growth of the UK economy. It's also just bad in the sense that you're just, the government is depriving itself of other kinds of tax revenues because none of this income is being declared.
Before we wrap things up, should we talk about capital gains tax? Because again, that was a big one in the budget, the fact that it's going to be cut from April from 28% to 24%. Just to remind everyone, this is the tax you pay on profit you make on an asset that's increased in value. Obviously, the big one we all talk about is homes, particularly second homes. You don't pay it on your main residence if you sell that, but you do on any additional ones. So lots of people are talking about this as a tax cut for landlords, Robert. But the Chancellor's hoping, isn't he, that this is going to, you know, encourage more transactions, and therefore it'll be a sweet point at which it'll bring in more tax revenue rather than less, even though it's a cut.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, this, because as you know, there is this big debate for donkey's years about whether you get more tax. Look, if you're on the right wing of politics, you make this argument that you end up getting more tax if you cut taxes, because you encourage transactions, you encourage activity. So more people, it's related to that point I was making earlier about, you know, if taxes are too high, people just go into the black economy and don't pay any tax at all. But there's this big debate in politics. Do you get more tax by having higher taxes, or do you have more tax by having low taxes that encourage growth and, you know, you encourage, you know, employment and all the rest of it. And over time, the Exchequer does better. The great Liz Truss mullered the public finances, or came close to mullering the public finances in her few weeks as Prime Minister with her tax cutting plans. Markets didn't like it throughout because they did not believe it would lead to enough growth in the short term. They just thought the deficit was going to explode. But she, you know, she's one of those people who says, cut taxes, economy grows, you get more tax in the long run. Mostly, this is a very complicated argument, but mostly the official forecasters, when you cut taxes, assume you lose money over a period of time. It is interesting. I've got the official red book, the Treasury's red book in front of me. And these are figures endorsed by the Office for Budget Responsibility. And in cutting capital gains tax from 28% to 24%, the Treasury is expecting tax revenues from capital gains tax on properties to grow by £310 million in the tax year that begins in April, and £350 million the following tax year. So they are expecting way more property transactions to be encouraged by these lower taxes. Now, I mean, we'll have to wait and see whether that's what transpires, but it is striking to me that the people who are paid to model these things, you know, in as far as possible a non-ideological way, are expecting higher tax revenues.
And I was expecting yesterday, do you know, when we get sent all those kind of bulletins from various sectors about their picks from the budget and, you know, what's going to impact them the most, whether it's like small businesses or, you know, various different sectors. I got my little update from Rightmove, which is obviously the property search site. And in it, I was thinking, oh, I'll have a look to see what they're saying about this capital gains tax. And it wasn't even mentioned in it. So they talked all about the removal of tax breaks for furnished holiday lettings, the end of multiple dwelling stamp duty. They didn't talk about capital gains tax.
That is really weird, because you only get all these extra hundreds of millions of tax if, you know, we get many, many, many more housing sales over the next couple of years. So it's interesting that somebody like Rightmove is not obviously forecasting that.
I went through it twice just to double check, and maybe they've got a bigger, you know, thing they're going to send out today. But they did make the point that there was no mention of the word mortgage in the budget. And given that is what everyone has been talking about for the last year, for him not to talk about mortgages.
I mean, the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, is known to own multiple properties. I think he's actually got a whole bunch of houses that he rents out. And I felt it was legitimate to ask him about whether he was going to benefit from this when I interviewed him yesterday, partly because he teased, I don't know if you noticed this, but Angela Rayner faced a bit of flack. She's faced a bit of flack because there's a question around when she sold her council house, you know, whether she paid the capital gains tax that some think she should have paid. I mean, as I understand it, I'm told by tax experts, if she did make a mistake, it was a sort of honest mistake in the sense that she just thought it was her main residence. And if she does end up having to pay tax, it's not going to be very much. But anyway, he teased her about how it was too late for this to benefit her. So I said to him, how much is this going to benefit you? He did look a bit sheepish.
Good question.
And he did this thing, which I thought was a bit dodgy. He said, that's a personal question. I said, but hang on a second, you were quite personal about Angela Rayner. Yeah. Anyway, he did tell me something which I thought was quite interesting and relevant, which is he said that obviously because he knows he's vulnerable to the charge that he's benefiting personally or would benefit personally from a tax reduction that he's introducing, he has given a public commitment now, and he said it on my show, that he will pay the 28% higher rate of tax voluntarily when he sells rather than the lower 24%. It is really weird, though, all the conflicts of interest in this budget for members of the government. I don't know if you were aware that the other thing that happened is we talked about the abolition of this non-dom tax break, and obviously Rishi Sunak, because he has a vested interest, did not take part, apparently, in any conversations about the non-dom tax changes, because obviously there's a bit of a conflict of interest there.
Yes, I imagine there's lots of conflicts of interest in the government that we don't hear about as well. Should we just wrap things up then? You know, everyone always says this at the end of a budget. Who are the winners and losers?
Well, look, the big winners just in the current year are, you know, those in work, particularly those on average earnings. You know, they have had a big bung through the cut in national insurance, which we talked about at length in our episode yesterday. The big losers are pensioners. I mean, there was literally nothing in it for pensioners. They suffer a lot, as everybody suffers. We've talked about this a lot. Not uprating tax thresholds in line with inflation is an enormously valuable to the government stealth tax, and it is a big raid on the incomes of millions of people, and you know that has not been altered at all. And so, you know, we shouldn't forget that despite this tax cut in the course of this parliament, taxes are going up to near record levels.
Right, we should wrap things up. I know we're gonna, in next week's episode, we're probably gonna look at a few more particular sector specific stuff. I'm really interested in what's happening in the TV sector, unsurprisingly, given I work in it, but not for that reason. There's a lot going on in the Northeast, and there was some stuff that's come out from the budget in regards to a massive new studios that are being built up in Sunderland that now look like they're going to be able to happen. So I'd quite like to focus on what's going on in the TV sector as well. But there'll be loads more to chew through next week too. But thank you very much for listening to us. If you've got any questions you want to ask us, any topics you want us to discuss, email us restismoney@gmail.com, or you can message us through our socials, The Rest Is Money. I wonder what I'll dream about tonight, Robert. Don't message me in the middle of the night, please, so I can have a night off from you. Right. See you later, love.
All the best. Bye.